Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry, that was a bit loud, wasn't it? Sorry. How are you doing? I thought I'd get this session kicked off. We've got to be out by four, and I don't want to be one of those people who ends up finishing things really late. This is a session about creative feature writing. And after all the stuff this morning, you know, all about genes and climate gate and all those sorts of various important issues about the future of journalism, I thought let's get down to the real stuff and think about language. Because at some level, we're all involved in language or creating sentences and words and paragraphs and text for people to understand something or communicate something. And not many of us, I think, have time to sort of sit back and reflect sometimes on what works, what doesn't, or to get any structure idea of what structures might work. And I think that it's always useful to do it, because if you're into creative writing, the idea of making something more than just tab A slots into tab B or something, then it's a very rewarding process. Now, I'm not going to say very much. What I'm going to do is hand over to our two speakers. Both of them will speak for roughly 10 minutes, and then it's mainly up to you to ask questions. And both of these guys are game for all sorts of practical tips to theoretical, philosophical concepts, anything you want to throw at them. I'll just introduce them first. First to speak will be Graham Lawton, the fearsome deputy editor of New Scientist. Honestly, they walk the corridors terrified of him. Graham, for a long time, was the features editor of New Scientist as well, and I'm told has a very interesting talk he gives to all of his writers, which you're all going to be lucky enough to get just now. And on his right is James Meek. I barely need to give him an introduction, but I will anyway. He is the former religious affairs correspondent, science correspondent, war reporter, essayist, and now novelist. And he will be talking about narrative as well. So let me start by asking Graham to come up.
Thanks, Alok. Okay, right, well, creativity. I feel a little bit of a fraud talking about creativity sat next to somebody who's genuinely a creative writer. That's not something that I can claim to be, but I can talk to you about feature writing after pretty much 10 years of editing and writing features for New Scientist. And obviously feature writing is something of a creative business, but again, I'm not going to talk to you about actually being creative, because real creativity is something that I don't know if anyone can really put their finger on what it is. What I'm going to try and teach you, or at least give you an idea of, is how to give the appearance of being creative, which is almost as important. It's a bit like sincerity. Politicians say sincerity is what matters. Once you learn to fake sincerity, you go everywhere. Here we go. I'm going to start off by reading you two pieces of writing. I want you to tell me which of them you prefer. Okay, they're not very challenging pieces of writing, not very long. The first one is called Busy Tractor. Okay. The tractor is in the field. The tractor is stuck. The tractor pulls the hay wagon. The tractor is sowing seed. The tractor rests in the barn. That's the end of Busy Tractor. I hope you were not hoping for more, because that's it. The second piece of writing I'd like to read to you is called Cat is Sleepy. Cat is sleepy. Where can he sleep? It's too noisy here. It's not comfortable here. It's too cold and slippery here. There's no room out there. Where can Cat sleep? At last, a cosy place. Okay, right, who preferred Busy Tractor? Who preferred Cat is Sleepy? I think everybody prefers Cat is Sleepy. Okay, now, there's a good reason why you prefer Cat is Sleepy, and that was the right answer, by the way. Cat is Sleepy is the superior of those two pieces of writing. Maybe the pictures are slightly better, it may be that the Cat Lee character is a little bit more compelling. But actually, I don't think it's that at all. There's a difference here that Busy Tractor is just information. Cat is Sleepy is a narrative. And that's a word, narrative, that we bandy around a lot. At New Scientist, definitely, and presumably all the kind of journalist outlets talk about narrative as if it's something that we all kind of instinctively know what a narrative is and how to do one. But I don't think that's true, and that's why I do this presentation for editors at New Scientist, writers at New Scientist, and now obviously for you, to try and get to the bottom of what we mean by narrative, how to know what a narrative is and how to go about building one with the material that you've got for your story. So fundamentally what a narrative is it's an intrinsically human way of communicating. All cultures tell stories, and a good story is loved by everyone. Everyone loves, for example, Cat is Sleepy. I've never met anyone who didn't like that story. It's part of human nature to tell stories and to listen to stories, to narratives, I should use the word, and enjoy them. Okay, but what is a narrative? Okay, and I'm going to show you now what a narrative is. That is a narrative. So a narrative is something that has a structure to it. It needs certain elements, and I've drawn them here. There's the protagonist, or hero, sometimes called. There's a thing called the inciting incident, which is something that happens to the protagonist or the hero, which causes the protagonist or hero to have a goal. And those are the three starting points that you need for a narrative. And then the narrative unfolds, because what happens is the protagonist attempts to get to the goal, but something, an outside force of some kind, pushes him or her away from the goal. And that's called a progressive complication. And this keeps on happening all the way through the narrative until eventually the protagonist arrives at his or her goal. So, in Cat is Sleepy, for example, who was the protagonist? The cat. What was the protagonist's goal? Sleep. And the cat kept on looking for places to go to sleep and eventually found, every time he looked for somewhere to sleep, he found that it was not suitable for sleeping, so he had to go look somewhere else. And that is kind of it. That's what the narrative was. Busy Tractor, on the other hand, the protagonist, you can kind of identify the tractor. But what was the tractor's goal? Did he ever get there? You know, no, we have no idea, because there is no narrative to that. There are millions of variations on this theme, and this is pretty much the kind of the most basic kind of narrative that you can get, and there are all kinds of variations. But pretty much any successful, particularly Hollywood movie, will always have this kind of narrative structure. And I'm kind of thinking of things here like Die Hard and Gladiator. Well, think of Gladiator as a classic example where, you know, I guess everyone's seen Gladiator, right? You can put your hand up if you haven't seen Gladiator. Okay, I won't. Close your ears, because I'm going to spoil it for you, okay? So there's a very clear protagonist in Gladiator. It's the gladiator, Maximus. There's a very clear inciting incident in that he is betrayed by the emperor Constant Commodius, and his wife and child are murdered, which makes him want to do two things, which are his goal. He wants to take revenge on the emperor, and he wishes to be reunited with his wife and his child in some way. And then everything that unfolds in the film after that is basically Maximus attempting to achieve those goals and various forces pushing him away from those goals that make him take ever greater actions to try and reach them. And of course, he eventually reaches them by... This is the spoiler, okay? So if you want us to see Gladiator, just don't listen now. He eventually kills Commodus in a fight and is reunited with his wife and his son in the afterlife. And it all ends. So that's it. And at this point, you're probably wondering, what on earth has any of this got to do with science? But I am coming to that, believe me. First of all, I want to kind of deal with why stories appeal to people, why it is that people respond to them. Well, first and foremost, people identify emotionally with protagonists, with heroes, because we all have goals, and we all come up against complications as we try to strive to achieve those goals. So in a good story, you end up rooting for the protagonist in the same way you kind of wanted Cat to find somewhere to sleep because you were rooting for him. There's also the element that a narrative brings satisfaction and closure to proceedings. Reaching the goal brings both emotional and intellectual satisfaction that you don't get from Busy Tractor, which is just information. The structure, we all instinctively understand narrative structure. So if you're reading something, a science feature, for example, and there's a narrative structure, you kind of know where you are in the narrative. You kind of know how close you are to the goal. And that just helps you move through a piece of writing in a natural way, because you're not wondering in the back of your mind, where the hell is this going? I mean, everyone's had that experience reading stuff. You know, God, why am I reading this? With a narrative, you always know why you're reading it. And then the really crucial thing, I think, is this thing called narrative drive, where you want to know what happens next, and that only happens with the narrative. You know, how on earth is the protagonist going to get there? How on earth is he going to overcome this one? How on earth is the goal ever going to be achieved? And you kind of delight in the twists and turns. And if you have narrative structure, it doesn't actually matter that you don't need to not know the ending. I mean, the entire Bond franchise is based on the idea that you know the ending already before you watch the film. Bond wins; he always does. The question is, how does he win? So that's the narrative gives you the narrative drive gives you the desire to keep on going even if you know what the outcome is. Okay, so how does this apply to science journalism? Because surely this is only fiction, right? Narrative almost synonymous with fiction. Well, I don't think that's true. I mean, I think science is actually natural narrative material because it's done by people, okay? People have goals. Scientists have goals. It's done by goal-driven people. Scientists are some of the most goal-driven people you will ever meet. They desperately want to find out that thing that they're working on, solve that puzzle, get to the bottom of that mystery, beat their rivals. You know, these are driven people. So you automatically, in a science story, in a science feature, you automatically have a protagonist and a goal. That's a given. It's about science. It has to have a protagonist and it has to have a goal. So the story is kind of there, and you don't have to impose it too hard. So if you're writing a science feature, one of the pieces of advice I would always give to somebody at the start of the process is write down, who is your protagonist? What is their goal? Yeah, if you know those two things, the inciting incident in science story is less important because it's often just the desire to know, or there might be an anomaly that crops up in some data that suggests that. How am I doing for time out?
You're all right. Give me 1 more minute.
Right. And then the progressive complications kind of sort themselves out. Often it's obvious that the scientists will try to do something that will get closer to the goal, and then something goes wrong, the data doesn't quite match, or some other finding comes in that stops this from working. And in that way, you can construct a narrative out of science. Often the protagonist isn't just a single person. It can be a kind of relay team protagonist where different research groups come in and become the protagonist for a while and try and solve the problem. Then another group comes in. It's a really useful way of ordering your material because you often find if you've done loads of interviews, you've read some research papers, you've got a stack of information, often different research groups doing all kinds of different things. How on earth are you going to turn that into a feature that people really want to read? And one way of doing it is to identify protagonists, to identify goals, to identify progressive complications, and literally build the story in this way. So you start with that, you go through the system. And if you do this, you'll end up with better features, and I can guarantee that. Because on a practical level, stories are compelling. Right? If you can tell a good story, more people will want to read your features. More people will like you as a writer. It gives you that organising principle for your material. And finally, this might sound like creativity by numbers, and it is. I mean, that's exactly what it is. Sometimes a feature is literally just going to flow, and you're not going to have to think about it in this way. Because the story is kind of there and you know it. More often, you've got more material than you know what to do with. You don't know how to structure it. You're struggling to come up with a compelling way of telling the story. My advice to you is use that structure because you can do a lot worse than use that, and it can turn sow's ears into silk purses if you use it properly.
Thanks, Graham.
I find nothing to disagree with in what Graham said. That was great. I've given this matter a lot of thought, and I think after much consideration that I prefer the tractor story. But that's just, you know,
you should do a rewrite, James,
they're already thinking, my God, what's this guy going to say? The most important thing that any feature writer should know about writing features is make sure you get paid. I'm just going to talk very, very briefly about how my very short career as a science writer, because I think there's something to be learned from that. In fact, I've been a writer all my life, ever since I was a child, when I started writing stories. And I was, in fact, a writer of fiction before I became a reporter. I always wanted to be a novelist. The journalism side of things was something that I did in order to make money, because I needed to eat while I was writing these books that nobody really wants to read. It sort of almost by chance it turned out to be both a very interesting job, being a journalist, being a reporter, and I turned out, I suppose, to be quite good at it. But I did do it in stages. So I did the classical thing. I started out in a little regional evening newspaper. I think the very first story I ever wrote was a three-paragraph story in the Northampton Chronicle and Echo about a man who was using stilts to repair a shop. That was it. That was the story. Gradually, I worked there for a few years. Then I moved to a bigger newspaper in Scotland. Then I went to Kiev to work as a freelance correspondent, writing about the breakup of the Soviet Union. Then I lived in Moscow for 5 years. I was Moscow correspondent for The Guardian. Then I came back, and of course, what you do with the Moscow correspondent of The Guardian, obviously you make them religious affairs editor of The Guardian, despite his atheistic tendencies. And then what do you do when you have a religious affairs editor who's just hitting his stride? Well, obviously you make them science correspondent. I was sitting there. The editor of The Guardian, Alan Rusbridge, he used to have these, still does for all I know, have these lunches where he will invite people, interesting people, to talk to a group of journalists. And I was in there one day as religious affairs editor, and John Sulston was talking. And I started sort of joining in and asking him a few questions, and I noticed the editor just sort of looking at me with that kind of strange expression, you know, a bit like sort of eyes meeting across the room. And I thought, I don't like the look of this. And sure enough, a few minutes later, the news editor came over and said, "Have you ever thought about writing about science?" So that was it. That was how I was recruited. I didn't have a science degree. I got very poor grades at school in science. The point I want to make is that the first skill that a science writer has is not the science, but the writing. That is the important thing. I was able to make a decent fist of the 2.5 years I worked as science correspondent, not because I was a scientist or because I became an expert of any kind. It sounds very paradoxical, but even so, as a good reporter, you need to be good at finding things out. Knowing too much can almost be a burden. What you bring to your story is ignorance. You bring to your story the same ignorance that the reader brings. You are the reader's representative. When you enter a world, even if perhaps over time you have actually become quite familiar with that world, the more you know about it, the more you have to remember what the reader doesn't know about it. The one key thing about journalism that I have brought with me from those years is that the secret is to know how to find things out without ever forgetting what it was like before you knew them. However, with science, there is a complication there, of course, because it is very technical, it is very specific, and you can't really get away just on your writing. I was very fortunate in the time that I was working for The Guardian in the biggest news story of the time, the biggest news stories being about genetics and biology, which are much more accessible to a non-scientist, and I'm talking about the reporter now. So I was able to gain enough knowledge in things like cell biology to understand more or less that the essentials of scientific papers, and to then convey that to the readers. If it had been something like quantum physics, I really don't think I would have been able to do that job, because despite what I said about ignorance, there is a certain level of ability to quickly make yourself master of the shallow details of a narrow subject in order to then convey that to the reader. So I was lucky there, I guess. But really, in the end, I think the best way to think of yourself as a writer of any kind is not as a teacher, because it's kind of hard for journalists really to be teachers, and not as a missionary. I mean, some of you may feel very passionate about science, may feel that it's that the British public in particular has this prejudice against anything to do with mathematics or science or technical. The country is gripped in this sort of romantic obsession. That's fine to have that feeling, but if you put too much sort of missionary zeal into your work, then I think it's going to degrade the effectiveness of what you're doing. That the best way to make a story work is to let the story tell itself, to let the information grip your readers, rather than you shouting at them, "This is really interesting, and you must read about this." And that's where we move on to the whole idea of storytelling itself. As Graham so rightly pointed out, it is all about stories. It always astonishes me how many times I've been with reporters, science reporters in science stories, war reporters at the same. They are much better tellers of stories around a table in a pub, very often, than they are in actually writing. And so I would listen to these old hands of science telling these wonderful stories, these wonderful gossipy anecdotes. I thought, God, this is great. I'm really looking forward to reading your story tomorrow. And then when the story came out, it was just so flat, so dry. They became, on the printed page, they were timid, they were cautious, they were conservative. They were sort of sticking to a press release. And I thought, if only you wrote like you talked. So when you're writing your features, do think of that. I mean, you can't make it too conversational. There are conventions that you have to follow. But think about reading it out loud. Think about how I would tell this story if I was telling this story. Perhaps even think about how you did tell that story when you came back from the place where you were doing your investigation, and your partner or your friend said, "Oh, how's it go?" And you picked out some little story. Maybe that little thing that you told the person but would never occur to you to put in your article, maybe that is exactly the thing that you want to put in. Graham is absolutely right about the protagonist, but although it's a very good idea to start thinking, who is my protagonist, it may be that as you write your story, you realize that, in fact, the protagonist is not the person that you thought it was. You may even see that there is an opposition, that not only is there a protagonist, but there's also a rival or some kind of villain or some kind of opposition in there, not just that the data isn't working out as the scientist thought, but that that some other scientist is going to get there first, or that some other scientist has a completely different take on this. It may emerge that you didn't realize it when you were doing the research, but as you look through your notebook, as you start writing the story, you see, hang on a minute, there's another story in there, and that's the one I want to tell. Or that's just the detail that is going to launch this story. There was a time when I did a piece for The Guardian about cancer. We did a big series about how cancer is treated in Britain today, and I did a few elements of that. And I went into a hospital, not knowing anything about medical science, not a doctor. I've never had cancer, fortunately. My family's not really had much experience of it. So I didn't really know what modern medicine did. And the first thing that staggered me, which is the sheer, extraordinary scale of the National Health Service's operation to beat cancer, it was just all these details and thousands and thousands of people whose jobs that I had never even heard of. But of course, when you go into a situation like that, the person that you go to interview you is completely used to all these things around them. For them, they're not special. They're not new. So they don't think to point them out. But you, as the reader's representative, you're thinking, my God, that's amazing. So I went into a room once in this hospital, which specialized in cancer treatment. And the entire room was just filled with these clear plastic masks. It was an extraordinary sight, the shelf on shelf of these moldings of people's faces, absolutely transparent plastic. And this was these were all moldings of people who'd had cancer, and these things had been specially made to fit over their faces and hold them still while radiotherapy was targeted at them, because it has to be very, very precise. And each one of these was a representative of a sort of frozen moment in time of somebody's battle with cancer. But the person who was showing me around, it was just, oh, now we're going through here. And I said, wait, what's this? What's going on here? So it wasn't exactly what I was writing about, but it made a great place to begin that story. Just a detail that I hadn't really suspected or imagined when I went in there, but I sort of found it by accident. So it was a way to kick off. And I'm sure you all know how hard it is to make that that first jump into a story. That's enough. I think I'm going to stop there because I'm sure Alok has some things he wants to bring up, and I'm sure you have some questions. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is maybe ask one or two questions first of Graham and James, and then I'm going to come to you. And in the meanwhile, perhaps as well as questions, if you want to sort of share your experiences of writing features that have become unexpected and the ways that you've tackled those things, that would be quite useful as well. Because one of the things that I want to ask these two eventually today is, what happens when you get stuck? When you have all this material, you know kind of what you want to write, but you've got no way of starting. How do you break that deadlock? But first, before I ask those things, let me ask you both. Is writing about science, do you think writing about science is different somehow to writing about, I don't know, James, writing about the war in Iraq?
Well, I kind of feel like I touched on this already with the talking about the technical side of science. You know, there are these areas where you do, despite what I said earlier about ignorance, you do have to have some knowledge. You know, to get to the starting point requires a little bit more work than it would. I don't know if Iraq is necessarily a good example because it's something the same. You know, it's helpful to know a little bit about military things if you're going into a war situation. But there are areas like crime reporting, for example, where, you know, you can just sort of start from scratch. And then it's purely your reporting skill, really, and your personal skills and getting to know people that helps you. You don't need to be an expert in forensics or anything like that. But I think of all the specialisms, and particularly when it is an area of science where the knowledge is so technical, where mathematics are involved, there you do need to do a little bit of extra work in order to get to the starting point.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I don't know for sure, because I only write about science. But I kind of look at it in the same way you look at music. There are only two kinds of music. There's good music and bad music. Yeah? And the same with writing. There's good writing and there's bad writing. And whatever it's about, if it's good, you know, brilliant. That's what we're looking for, good writing.
But in terms of language, scientists use impenetrable language sometimes, often, in fact, to talk to each other. Language that, as a journalist or a writer, you might have to come across and then explain. In terms of the language, how careful do you have to be about using things like the word isostasy or the word or mitochondrion or words like that liberally in text? I mean, is it okay? Is that something you worry about?
When I was working in Moscow, somebody said something to me which I thought was very true. This was the 1990s, and he said, and this goes back to what I said about how you can't be a teacher as a journalist. He said that the British public can learn the names of two Russians every year, and that is it. And they'll forget those names the next year, they'll learn two other names. And I think that applies to science. Sometimes you can, and sometimes you have to introduce a new word. But yeah, for God's sake, don't put too many. And one per article is already pushing your luck.
Do you have more than one per article in New Science? Can you have two per article?
I think we can stretch to two on special occasions. But the thing about those words is, I think when you're writing, the thing to do is just to use the words that you're familiar with. And it's always a judgment call about whether a word like mitochondrion, for example, or LHC...
It's such a great word, though. I mean, yeah. I love the word mitochondrion. Yeah. And in fact, I use it in the novel I've just finished.
Right. I can't wait to read that. From a sort of technical writing point of view, those words are often stumbling blocks that if you're going to have to explain what you mean by those things, then you actually have to stop the flow of your narrative and wedge this thing in there that... explains. That's one of the hardest things to get right, because when you have those stumbling blocks in stories, I mean, those are the points where people stop and they go and read something else, or they look at the diagram, or they read the box, or they turn the page, and that's it is really difficult to find a way of stopping, explaining something, and moving on with the narrative.
James, you've hinted you're a novelist, very successful one. Is your fiction writing persona very different thing to your reporting persona, or is there a sort of continuum between the two?
Well, it's a kind of boring answer, but I've been asked this question just about every single event I've done in the past 5 years.
Oh, thanks.
I say that because you'd think that I would have a good answer by now, but I have noticed that I tend to give completely different answers. I think really, having thought about it so much, the answer is no. I mean, they are different personas, and really, the two writings, I've never had any difficulty keeping the two worlds.
Does one inform the other?
Part. Well, I mean, I suppose any kind of writing is practice for any other kind, on a kind of, at least on a sentence by sentence level. I then think that the writing novels sort of hurt my journalism. And certainly once you get into the longer form of journalism, I mean, it is a very difficult jump to make. I found it difficult to go from writing 300-word stories to 500-word stories to 800-word stories. You know, once you get to there's a certain point you reach, I think 1,000 words is about as long as you can go before you have to start a new kind of writing. And what I mean by that is you have to move into the kind of writing where you start and then you start again about halfway through. So you'll sort of, you know that the readers have followed this thought, this scene, this train of thought, and there's a danger of them getting a little bit bored. So you sort of start another little chapter of the story. You're not going off completely at a tangent, but you're coming at it from a slightly different direction. So once you have to do that kind of writing, I mean, the zigzag that that you drew is I guess, something to do with this. You can't just have a single line of narrative if your story gets over a certain length, and you know, most features are longer than a thousand words.
The change of scene is a really important thing to freshen things up at a certain point. But I think you're right. Yeah, up to maybe 800 words, the structure doesn't matter so much. But beyond that, that's when you need to understand and you need to plot and plan the structure of the thing that you're going to write. It's not something you can just sit and write through. We can sometimes, but it tends to be better if you at least have some kind of plan. I mean, I don't really think of myself as a writer. I'm an editor, and I'm a kind of, that's like being the manager of a rock band. You know, the other people do the creative stuff, and I just kind of crack the whip on them.
Go on.
But it's certainly easier for me as an editor to write with to work with writers who know what they're doing. You know, who can write well.
But you know, the last thing I want to do by saying that is make anyone frightened of the 1,000-word barrier. I mean, don't be frightened. The main thing that I know you're going to ask, what do you do when you get stuck? And because I think it relates to this, just write. You know, just start writing. It doesn't matter any kind of rubbish. Just start writing. As soon as you put that first sentence down, everything looks different. It doesn't mean that you've solved your problems. On the contrary, your problems are just beginning. But you have, but you have at least got something there, and you can either you think, oh, that's actually quite good, I could go with that, and write the next sentence, and on you're off. Or you think, no, that's completely wrong. But you at least have an opposition to work with. That's wrong, and maybe it'd be better if I did this. So you know, if you're stuck, just start. Just write anything.
And don't worry about where you're starting. You don't have to start at the beginning. You can often start in the middle.
And once you've finished it, you can then rewrite it.
Its way out.
And you probably will. You might take the middle and make it the beginning, or the end and make it the beginning.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's time to ask you guys to come up with questions or experiences. Anyone want to ask anything straight away? Matt?
I used to work with Graham New Scientist, and there was a question we had internally that might be good to try and answer. This idea about, can the protagonist be an inanimate object or not a person or not something capable of taking action, is something that potentially is more peculiar to science, because a lot of the things of interest in science are nouns and objects. We used to sort of have that debate about, could you have a feature, say, about gravitational waves, and the features are kind of about the gravitational waves, yet you want to introduce a protagonist who can take action. Did you kind of resolve that debate, and do you have kind of comments around that?
I stand on that where I always have done, in that to be a protagonist, you have to be able to have goals, and inanimate objects can't have goals. And if you give them, then you're anthropomorphizing that word that I couldn't pronounce then, and I still can't pronounce now. And I'm not a fan of that. But I think a very skilled writer could probably pull it off. I mean, you do see that in the carbon atom in Primo Levi's famous story about the carbon atom is kind of a protagonist, and it doesn't feel cheesy, but you know, he's a brilliant, amazing writer. So I think you're better off sticking with people.
And do you think it's a kind of, I sense this mistake we all make when we're starting out as one in sciences, we sort of take a subject and think, I'm going to write about a mitochondria, and you kind of forget that, although that may be the thing at the thread of interest, you need to shape the story differently. It's not an essay on mitochondria, it's a feature with protagonists.
People do write essays on mitochondria, but that's science writing rather than science journalism, and I think there are two different kinds of beasts really there.
It's a very broad field, and of course there may be stories you write where the protagonist, the human side of it, is reflected as much in the people who are affected by something as the scientists who are trying to do something about it, or trying to find out about it, or trying to change it. You know, I mean, I don't quite know how that would apply to gravitational waves, because we're all affected by gravity. I fell down yesterday. It's not a very good start. I don't know. That might work. A lot of medical stories, obviously, it's about the person with the illness or the condition, and it may be that the narrative spine of your story is the story of that person and how they first experienced the condition, the problem, how they then went on to try and find out more about it, how they were diagnosed, how they learned that there was this new treatment for it, how it worked, how it failed, whatever. And the scientists then come in as sort of incidental. So it doesn't have to be that the scientist is the protagonist.
Okay, more questions? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Caroline Bloomer. Another form of writing that I've been involved with, as I've been working in PR as part of my time, and when in PR, we often don't have a human protagonist, but we still have to make an interesting feature article that we can pitch to some editor somewhere. And the style we've often looked at doing is enunciating a problem, then talking about what one does to try and find the solution to the problem, which is a bit like your complications, and then getting to a solution in the end, which obviously hopefully helps promote the client that you're trying to publicise in your article. But there isn't a protagonist that's human at all, but there is a problem to be solved. Now, how does that work? Does it not work at all? You have to completely forget that idea?
I think you'll find there is probably a human protagonist in there, because somebody's got to do the work to solve the problem, and that's the protagonist. I mean, don't misunderstand me here. The protagonist doesn't have to be a huge part of the story. It doesn't have to be like Maximus the Gladiator, where the whole story is about that person. It can be almost an incidental character in this telling of how the science problem was cracked. This is not so much a system for writing features, but for organising your material. The protagonist can literally appear once in the story, when you introduce the research group that's doing the work, and then you talk about the work that they did. But then implicit in that is that this is being done by a protagonist. And if you analyse those pieces of writing in that respect, you'll find protagonists in there for sure. Because only humans can do these things.
James, anything to add on that?
Nope, that sounds good to me.
Okay. Anyone else?
Yeah. John Travis from Science, and maybe this is for Graham. Have you changed how you're editing features in the last 5-10 years with online revolution? I mean, early on there was a thought that readers wouldn't go deep into a story, and a lot of worry about whether feature writing would go away. And I think a lot of the data is suggesting people will read very long stories on the internet if they're compelling. But I'm wondering whether you think about how it is going to be portrayed online when you're editing a print feature?
No, not really. And I think probably because our experience is just the same, that if you look at the figures that we get, the most popular articles in New Scientist online, newscientist.com every week, are the features. They're the most read, and they often beat news stories tenfold. I mean, we maybe get 200,000 people will read the most read feature, and 20,000 people will read the most read news story. So it's a myth that people won't engage with long-form journalism online. But I do think it's important that you get your compelling narrative going in a feature, because that's what drags people through. You know, the idea is to write a feature that once you've started reading it, you've got to finish it. You know, that's the idea. And you know, this suggests to me that we've at least got that to a certain extent, because people are clearly starting to read our features online, and they're finishing them. So it's not the ideal reading medium, but people seem to still stick with it. I mean, I don't know how you find about your own reading behaviour, but I'll read a feature online, no problem.
What's the sort of behaviour here? I mean, do people feel like they can read thousands of words on a screen? I know a lot of people at The Guardian, for example, feel that you have to be short as possible now. We still have a feature section, of course, and magazines and so on. But do you tend to read lots of long things online?
Depends on the size of the screen. I wouldn't read something long on this if it dragged enough.
I mean, we do sort of chop things up a bit and repurpose, add extra crossheads and stuff to break things up a bit. But the basic structure of the feature is exactly the same as it would appear in the magazine.
It has such advantages, reading a long feature about science online, in the sense that there's plenty of opportunity for explanatory links. But I don't feel that the people who run websites have necessarily exhausted all the possibilities of presenting this material. I was very interested to see that this series the Washington Post is running about Top Secret America this week. For the first time, I think they had a sort of a page that was like a letterbox width for their text story. I mean, there was about 16 pages of this story, but they did it like slides. So it was almost like a slideshow, but it was text. That seemed to me a very agreeable way of presenting a story in sort of 16 screen-sized chunks, not scrolling down, but sliding along.
Who's next? Yeah.
One comment. I'm Joanna Carpenter, freelance science writer. I will certainly read up to four pages of feature if I have a page and then just click to go to second page and then a page and click to go to third page. Graham, you mentioned diagrams and boxes and that, you know, when things start getting a bit dry in a feature, that's when people start reading the diagram and so on. If you're writing a feature, why include diagrams and boxes? And should you plan that at this point you expect the reader to read this diagram or this box? Or when I'm reading New Scientist, I find that I don't know when in the feature I'm actually meant to be accessing that information. Do I read the whole thing through and then read it at the end
answer,
or what?
You know, that is the correct answer. There is no moment in the feature where you're supposed to go to... We'll refer people to them in the text if you need to, but... What they're actually there for, and I'll give a secret away here, is when people are browsing the magazine in a newsagent's, the first thing they look at are the diagrams, the boxes in the features. So they're supposed to be little advertising things to people, say, this is an interesting feature, you want to buy this magazine. They're less for the reader of the feature who's already committed to buying the thing than they are to the person who might just buy them.
That's really useful, I didn't know that at all.
They're supposed to be little standalone stories that get people interested, and then maybe we'll make them want to buy the magazine to read the longer feature.
And if somebody's writing a feature, should do you expect them to provide separate material for a box or a diagram, or is that something that you would do editorially?
In the editing process, it's very much a two-way process between the editor and the writer, and we generally work out between us what the best way to go is, or the editor makes those kind of decisions. But it really depends from story to story.
There was a question out the back.
Andy Excellence, freelance. In your narrative journey, you end up at a goal, and you've been very much talking as if that goal is complete, but in Cutting Edge Science, a lot of the time, when we're writing about it, we still don't know what the answer's going to be. So how does that affect the narrative journey?
Yeah, I mean, you don't actually have to find the Higgs boson or whatever to get the... I mean, you've got to choose your goal carefully. It's got to be an achievable goal. As long as the reader... It can be a halfway point to the ultimate goal or a smaller goal than the ultimate goal. The point really being that the reader needs to know what they're trying to achieve, you know, what the goal is. Even if you don't say it explicitly, it's got to be implicit in the narrative what they're trying to do. And that actually even a satisfying narrative can get people kind of halfway, partway to a goal as long as they achieve something. But yeah, it's not like the goal has to be the final theory.
James, do you have any thoughts on goals? In fiction writing, do you always have to come to an end at the end?
That's a big point of discussion in fiction. I don't know whether that's all that relevant here, because you know when you're writing a novel, it's a different. But a lot of people argue about that. You know, how do you end a novel? I think it's harder more unfair, more unreasonable to leave the readers of a feature sort of hanging in midair. We all know that lame ending of a feature. You know, only time will tell. It's not a nice way to end. But in fact, it is interesting, this whole question of ending, because it is always arbitrary. Things don't actually end. It's true what people say, that any kind of writing does tend to have that structure. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end. And a really good features writer will probably spend as much time crafting the end of their piece as they will crafting the beginning. I mean, I think you do want people wanting more. You want to leave people wanting more. You don't want to make it sounding too final, as if everything has been solved. You want to leave it a little bit mysterious and open. But at the same time, it is good to get some kind of sense of closure. I mean, I suppose I'm probably guilty a lot of ending features with a quote. If somebody can provide something which often is only time will tell, but they put it in so much of a more better, eloquent way. But it's that's an area. I mean, everyone is used to talking a lot about the beginning of a feature, but it tends to get discussed less how you end. But it's really is something to think about. I mean,
if you think starting is hard, ending is twice as hard, isn't it? You know, to get to that point where you can say that's finished now. But it's an interesting sort of philosophical question, I guess, about, and people sometimes bring this up when we talk about narrative, is this, well, you're kind of imposing your own system on reality there, but reality is kind of messy and stuff happens all over the place. And until somebody tells a story about something, then what actually happened doesn't make any sense to people. You know, everything we tell about history is a fiction, a sort of narrative account of what really happened. So I'm pretty comfortable with the idea of kind of imposing a narrative on something that isn't actually necessarily a narrative structure as it unfolded. You know, you tell the story as a story, and then it makes sense to people.
Absolutely. I mean, in a way, this rather strange title for the session of creative feature writing, I mean, I suppose that's where it's most applicable, in the sense that when you are structuring this messy reality of the world, you are imposing a narrative on it, however you tell the story. I mean, if only because a feature of any kind, or even a news story of any kind, is about what you leave out as much as what you put in. It's all about the leaving out. You're always facing that hard wall of the number of words that you've got to play with. And that, in the end, is one of the most powerful determinants of the kind of feature you're going to write. If you're told there's only room for 2,000 words, there's no point in writing 4,000, even though I usually do.
This is a point that Tim Radford made quite a lot about what you leave out. I just wondered, internally, when you're writing, say, 2,000 words as for a feature, New Scientist feature, or for anywhere else, do you internally have in your head a number of new points you can make in that many words? I mean, I know I do. I think if someone says to me you've got 800 words or 2,000 words, I know I can make about 3 points, rough new points, in an 800 words, probably about 5 in 2,000 words, and that's it. So I therefore can cut everything else out. I pick the top 5. It's a changes, but.
That's useful advice I've heard today. write that down.
Yeah. I would think of it in terms of how many progressive complications, yeah. How many cycles of toing and froing can you get through. And I think in a 2,500 word feature, 3 or 4 is about right. Like, which is why this extremely simplistic structure, it is just about good enough, because you ain't ever going to tell a more complicated story.
I mean, to me, it's very unusual, this session, because it's very rare that people actually talk about these things. I don't know how it is on The New Scientist, because you obviously have some kind of program, but The Guardian is this terribly mysterious place where nobody will actually ever dare to tell you to tell you what it is you're supposed to do. You know, either you can do it or you can't. And it can be quite painful sometimes. I mean, what I'm saying is I don't actually know how other people write features. I only know how I write my own. Every now and again, you'll look over somebody's shoulder or somehow something will get to you by accident, and you'll see somebody has this great plan for the thing that they're writing. You think, my God, I just don't write that way. I mean, I am a very slow writer. And one of the reasons I'm so slow is that I will read what I have written over and over and over again. I mean, if I write a 2,000-word feature, you can be sure that I have read the first paragraph that I've written 100 times, at least. And I do sometimes wonder whether writers who seem to struggle more with long articles aren't actually reading them through enough times when they write them. But, you know, as I say, I don't really know how other people operate.
Okay, there's a question there at the back.
Hi, I'm Mankit Lewin from the Wellcome Trust. I just want to add to what you just said, actually. I for one, really appreciate this session because in my department, we've talked a lot about feature writing and how to approach feature writing and the different types of ways that people, the different types of narrative that people use in feature writing. And it's true, people don't get into a room enough to kind of talk about these kind of things and explore it from a creative viewpoint. The point I wanted to make was just to kind of go back to what you were saying about the ending being as important as the beginning. I have a big discussion with my friend who's a screenwriter and a playwright, and he often makes the point that when it comes to a lot of creative fiction based mediums, the ending is actually very important because you can come out of, say, a film, and if 2/3 of that film has been complete crap, if the ending is somehow extremely satisfying, you'll come out with a better opinion of that film than maybe the whole thing is overall. And I read something in the Guardian Weekend magazine, actually, this from, I think it was Oliver Berkman, in his column, was saying something about, I think it was something called like, the end complex or something. So we tend to have a much more satisfactory feeling of something that we've read or something that we've watched with, which seems to tie things up very nicely or seems to leave you with a good, satisfied feeling at the end of it. So I completely agree. When it comes to crafting your feature, I think the ending is as important, if not maybe more important, than the beginning or kind of the bits in the middle.
Oliver Berkman also.
Trouble is they have to get them.
Yeah. That's true.
But you're absolutely right. That's very, very well said. Because if somebody does finish a work, then the ending can define, is very likely to define their feeling about the whole thing, and it can raise it if the previous passages haven't been so strong.
This is why I think, despite the classic three-act structure that Star Wars has, I think that the ending of Return of the Jedi is so awful, it makes you colours the rest of it for you. Anyway,
this brings in the sort of classic journalistic trick of what's called the kicker, where something unexpected happens at the end, or you suddenly push the story off in a totally different direction. Often suggests a sequel, which is quite handy if you're writing novels or screenplays. But, to do it... So, rather than just kind of wrap the story up neatly, to bring something totally new and unexpected in at the end is a useful technique, as long as it's relevant.
Yeah.
Hi, Henry Nichols, freelance. Graham, you mentioned history being all about telling stories, and something I have found very useful for me is to use history of science in contemporary features. It's much more easy to much easier to tell a sort of story from the past, and to maybe make a historical protagonist. How do you feel about features about contemporary science that bring in history or blend? Is that a useful thing? Is that something you recognise?
Yeah, I mean, I've edited your features, Henry, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I'm not quite sure I know what you mean to use historical characters
well,
in contemporary features.
I found it immensely useful, so...
Yeah.
I would suggest anyone who's perhaps struggling to think about historical angles to their feature.
You mean how we got to where we are now?
There's always going to be a historical moment that you could peg.
So if you're
your
writing about anaesthetics,
feature.
For example, and you go back to the first discovery, the moment when...
It needn't... Yeah, I mean, you could do that, but...
That's not what you meant. It is
sort of, only that's perhaps a bit simplistic to take, you know, the most obvious moment. There's going to be some interesting story that people haven't heard about that ties in perhaps the main people that you're interviewing. Maybe they share a sort of academic history. They were in the same lab. There's an institutional history to a story. And you can maybe even resurrect a kind of retired scientist and get a voice from the past that gives your feature a kind of a progression through time.
I think what you're talking about, if I may, is something wider than that. I mean, you're talking about the past, but there's also... Well, what you're talking about is the way of getting people interested in a feature by picking on something specific and concrete, some episode... which happened not necessarily, it might be in the past, but it might also be in an unexpected place, or somebody who is not going to be the main protagonist in the story, but just something strange happened to them, and it was this observation by this peasant in Nigeria which sparked the story that you're then going to. I mean, it's there's different kinds of doing that, but it's all the same thing. It's sort of starting in one place, getting people interested, and then moving to the
I think there's something different, and it's happening in my head, and it's the way I curate information from scientists who are active now, who are telling me something now, and the way I deal with historical information. I'm much more relaxed about the fictionalizing element of that.
How do you mean?
In terms of relaxing to tell a really good story. If it happened 50 years ago, I'm not that bothered about it. Whereas if I talk to someone who's in the lab now and I ask them, did it happen like that? And he goes, no, not really. Well, I'm not going to make it up how it happened.
You're talking about fictionalizing some...
Yeah, so there may have been something that happened.
Interesting area.
I would love to tell, you know, you would love it if they said it happened like this and it didn't happen like that, so you can't tell it. Historically, the people are all dead. You're not a historian.
You're worrying me. Now you're worrying me a bit.
We're getting into a little bit of a whether you can fictionalise in journalism or not question here, which that's roughly speaking you're talking about.
We are talking about creative features creative. Session. Correct me if
you need if you need to use the technical parts. If you need an inciting incident that the reader will then understand why people are behaving as they do as the story unfolds, then a historical one is just as good as any other if that really is the thing that makes the protagonist desire to reach their goal.
I think so.
Narrative non-fiction, I suppose, is what I'm talking about. So where you would create a scene from the past that can't be verified because the archival material is not there, the people are all dead, but you could bring to life a moment from the past. You can't do that with the present if it's really dull. And
but as long as you're making it clear that you've made it up.
Well, I think it is pretty clear, isn't it?
Because I like to know, as a reader...
Well, this is a live debate in fiction with things like The Damned United, for example, where it's the sort of...
Yeah, but you know that's a novel.
But when you're reading it, you sort of forget that, don't you? I don't know if you've read it. But
I have read it. It's a great book. It's a great book, but it's a novel. Yeah. And it's clear on every single page that it's a novel because you are getting the internal life of the imagined Brian Clough. And David Peace is not Brian Clough. Brian Clough is dead, therefore... You can't. He's obviously making it up, and that's on every page.
I found myself thinking reading that book: which parts of this are real and which parts are fiction.
Yeah, so that's fair enough. But I mean, it's all enclosed for me within this sort of fictional framework. Whereas, if you have a piece of journalism and it's not flagged up in some pretty obvious way that the writer is just making it up, then I personally have a problem with that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think you want to write a
I'm not making it up, no.
Let's move on. We should probably move on because we're nearly the end of the session. There's probably time for one tiny question if anyone's got one. Otherwise, yeah?
Hi, Katrina Miggett. I'm a freelance journalist. I just wanted to say that some of the best features that I've read don't have very many quotes in them, and I was just wondering what your thoughts were on including quotes in features.
We're trained as journalists to always include quotes, aren't we?
Every 15 minutes you've got to put a quote in there as you're writing. No, I mean, I don't know, I'm kind of agnostic on this. If you've got good quotes and they work with the story that you're trying to tell, use them. If not, you don't necessarily need them, but they provide a nice change of pace and a sense of, you know, in the same way that you know with The Damned United you're reading fiction, with quotes you know you're reading journalism, and that's helpful.
Also, I mean, it's I know exactly what you're talking about because... often people speak in a really boring way and you don't want to kind of spoil your beautifully written article by putting their boring comments in. I find there's one tip which I have learned, which I think not many journalists do, but I found it works, and that's to put your questions in. Because sometimes you will ask a question which you think perhaps is quite a good and interesting question, and the scientist will say yes or no. You know, you can't quote that, but you can quote your question, so you can actually put the dialogue in. I'm surprised that doesn't happen more often, because I found it to be very effective. It gives you a sense of a meeting, of an encounter. It gives you, perhaps it's a way of showing the reader where you are going with a story. It sets up a little bit of a relationship between the reader, the possibility, which we haven't talked about, of you, the writer, becoming something of the protagonist. You know, that's another kind of feature writing. Not for beginners, perhaps, but it can work very well. So that's one possibility. If you don't have good enough quotes, then you can quote yourself in the form of dialogue, you know, in that way. And sometimes you may make yourself, you know, it can be comical because you make yourself actually sound stupid in a sort of comical way, asking some terribly pompous question, and then be deflated by the scientist. You know, there's all sorts of fun you can have in that way.
Okay, we'll probably have time to wrap up the session, but I'm going to ask each of the panelists just one more thing, which is that they say that to write well, you have to read lots. So who would be your two recommendations for this group to go off and read immediately? Graham?
You could do a lot worse than read the science journalism that James did for The Guardian, which was fabulous. Yeah. Jo Marchant is one of my favourite writers. She's a cracking writer. She writes features and she writes books, popular science books.
She wrote a book called Decoding the Heavens about the Antikythera mechanism and has made a career out of talking about it ever since.
I know, yeah.
There's so many writers that I could mention. Unfortunately, I've forgotten the name of the guy who wrote that wonderful book, The Making of the Atom Bomb. Who? Anyone? The Making of the Atom Bomb? Well, check it out. It's a masterpiece. But the two writers that I printed out on my way here were a guy called Dennis Overby, who is an American writer. He writes about cosmology. And I read one of his books. He managed to make it utterly engaging, fascinating, without ever mentioning any detail of the incredibly complex mathematics that lay behind all this. Dennis Overby.
He's worked for the New York Times, yeah. But also writes pop science books.
Interestingly, though, he gave that book an appalling title. He called it, Cosmic Lonely Hearts. Which I thought was a terrible title, very off-putting. It just shows you can have this wonderful book that can be rather damaged by a bad title. The other guy, Tim Burkhead, he wrote a superbly entertaining book called Promiscuity, all about the sex lives of birds and insects, which is an absolute masterpiece of how you can cull literally hundreds and hundreds of scientific papers, each one having one beautiful little nugget of information. You can take the life's work of a single scientist, squeeze it down to a single paragraph, put it in your book, and make lots of money.
Okay, well, my own recommendation, if anyone's interested, would be Steven Weinberg's Dreams of a Final Theory, which is all about quantum physics and search for theory of everything, he would hate that summation of the book because he thinks that there isn't one. But it's a fantastic book about very, very hard things. I think the session is now over. I just wanted to give a hand to James Meek and to Graham Lawton.